I'm Algernon Cash, and you're locked in. Too often, we have the conversation about tariffs, and it feels so distant, like it's only about foreign policy or global economics. But here in North Carolina, the impact is real and personal. It's hitting our family-owned farms, our local manufacturers, and the small businesses that keep our communities going. Today, I am joined by Zeb Williams, whose family revived Old Nick Williams Distillery, and Bob and Marlo Ivy, a father and daughter carrying on their hog farming tradition in eastern North Carolina. These are stories you won't hear on the evening news, but they matter. Because when small businesses suffer, entire communities feel it. If you believe in local, if you care about who's really carrying the weight, then tune in, share this conversation, and help us bring more voices like theirs to the forefront. I am so grateful to have all of you all locking in with me today. Marlo, you're an old friend. Welcome back. Bob's a new friend. Glad to have you. And Zeb is a high school friend. So definitely so happy to have him. And so I'm going to start with Zeb, if I can. Zeb, I think to just jump right at it and go directly to the main question, how have tariffs impacted you and your ability to source materials and perhaps even sell your products?
You know, up until this point, it hasn't affected us too heavily, but now we're getting into the point where we're requiring glass again and starting to look at the prices with the tariffs. We're not going to be able to afford the glass that we've been buying for years. You know, a lot of us small distilleries here across the United States ran into trouble getting or sourcing glass from the manufacturers during COVID. So many of us stuck roots into China and invested dollars and time into establishing relationships, and now can't afford the glass that we spent the last 3 years acquiring.
Yeah. So you mentioned, Zeb, that you buy the glass from China. At one point in time, were you sourcing the glass from some other place, or are you able to actually manufacture the glass here in America?
Well, I mean, it can be manufactured here in America. You know, we'll just break it down. If you try to afford a mold for a specific or a custom piece of glass here in the United States, you might be looking at $15,000, $20,000, $25,000 for the mold. In China, that's going to cost you $2,500 to $5,000. So it gives you the ability to be a little bit more diverse, add more bottles to your collection, and give you different avenues you wouldn't be able to do here in the United States. And before COVID, most of us were sourcing our glass from either suppliers or manufacturers here in the United States. However, most of that glass was made in either China or India or Mexico, and they were just being the ones importing it before all of this. So, you know, glass has come from overseas for a long time. They've nailed it down. I'm getting better quality, a lot cheaper product, and you know, for something that's just packaging, it's going to be thrown in the garbage anyway. To me, it's you know, just part of the game.
And for some of us that only consume bourbon, like myself, and don't manufacture it, help us understand what percentage of that cost is the glass, right? Like you think about the actual liquid on the inside, but most people don't think about the packaging and all the things that go into to getting it on the store shelf.
You know, it's just like everything. The more bells and whistles you put on anything, the more expensive it's going to be. You can get glass as cheap as 50 cent a bottle, all the way up to several dollars a bottle, depending on how fancy you want to go with the package. You know, in the liquor store, you see some of these fancy bottles shaped like guns or the state or whatever. You know, those custom pieces of glass are going to get up into $3 and $4 a piece. So the packaging can be a very expensive part of the product, which is why it's important to try to acquire it as reasonable as possible.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense. I guess to shift over to you, Marlo, You came back. You came on the show some years ago. You talked about the last time we were in this trade war back in 2018, and the impact to your farm. Tell us what you're anticipating this time around. I mean, what are you and your friends, your family, what are you guys talking about as it relates to how this round of tariffs may impact your hog farm?
Well, I mean, I think, it really boils down to agriculture as a whole on tariffs have always gotten the short end of the stick. I mean, agriculture's never really been at the forefront of people really concerned with tariffs and honestly how taken advantage of we as farmers are from other countries. For example, Canada, they put a 200% tariff on milk that we're importing into Canada. So from that kind of perspective, with these tariffs, I think agriculture has always ridden the wave of it, and always gotten the short of the stick. But at the same time, we've been taken advantage of the whole time when it comes to tariffs. So I mean, I feel like, in agriculture, we're always looking to the future and we're always looking to move forward. And sometimes, you have to go through the hard times to get to the better times. Tariffs are going to affect us the same way they're going to affect any business. But I think at the end of the day, if we don't stand up for ag from an ag standpoint and to some of these countries that are taking advantage of us, it's just going to continue to happen. And we're going to continue to get the short end of the stick. And Dad can speak a lot on that too, just because we've had a pretty open relationship with the Japanese market and the pork that we've exported to them. So, I mean, he would have another kind of perspective. But for me, as a millennial trying to keep my farm sustainable, continue to grow it, I mean, at some point, somebody's got to stand up for ag and go to bat for us.
And I see your dad is with us. I don't see his video. I'm wondering if he can hear us. Bob, are you still there with us?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Yeah, go right ahead. I mean, I think you heard the conversation and Marlo's response, but feel free to chime in there.
Okay, well, I represent a lot of farmers across the United States, hog farmers across the United States. I'm on the National Pork Producers Council Board of Directors, which is elected and represents a voluntary checkoff program, and our main focus is trade for the swine industry. 25% to 30% of all of our pork raised in this country goes out of this country, so trade is very important. Our trading partners that we have free trade agreements like Canada, Mexico, are our best trading partners. China has never been a dependable trading partner for us, and so usually they are retaliating over something with the farmer, so they're not very dependable. I had a good fortune to go to Washington, D.C., and actually, as a board, we met with the trade representatives in the West Wing of the White House to talk about trade. And that's about 2 weeks ago, and it's a very volatile situation. But of course, the Chinese, they've cut us off, but it opens the door for other countries that we've never been able to get into. One example of that would be Vietnam. They have 100 million people. They have a 10% tariff, or I think it may be more than that, but that they impose on our industry, which means that we can't get pork products there. And 100 million people, and they eat pork and they consume the same thing that the Chinese eat, such as parts of the pig that typically we don't like. So it's a very that can represent as much as $8 onto the carcass when we sell it. So we're very excited about getting some new trade agreements with people like Vietnam, or countries like Vietnam, because they could really make up much of the ore that goes to China, and we think that This is going to open those doors and other doors like the Philippines and other countries where not only do we have trade tariffs that tariffs from those countries that prevent us from exporting our products, but it also they have a lot of non-tariff barriers. In the last 4 years, the Biden administration really hasn't addressed agricultural trade. So we see it as a real opportunity to reset our trading with our neighbors and really come out in a better situation. Our biggest trading partners would be Canada and Mexico. They're very good trading partners. We have free trade agreements with them. That's been impacted some now. And we have hogs go across those borders all the time, both ways. But we think that I was fortunate enough to meet with some Canadians at their embassy, and we believe that we're on track to get the differences worked out with those situations to get things back to normal for that. So for us, it would be more, it would be opportunities that we didn't have before.
Bob, I appreciate you providing that insight, and had no idea that you were so close to it in terms of some of the negotiations and what's being discussed. So I really appreciate that unique and expert insight. I guess let's stay there for a moment. Because, Bob, I would say that I think anyone that has common sense would agree that the trade agreements here in our country and the trade agreements with our international partners were not 100% fair. They needed to be restructured, and we needed to look at the process that we go about in terms of trading with our international partners. I think that's all agreed. I think for me and many of the people that I talk to, and I want to get your reaction to this, I think the method by which we're going through to negotiate these agreements or renegotiate these agreements, I think that's what appears to have people so taken off guard, and the uncertainty that has crept into our markets and our economy. I think that's why the markets are reacting the way they are. No one anticipated just the level of tariffs that were going to be implemented on April 2nd. I want to get your reaction to that. I mean, did you anticipate it being this level and this type of a process that we're going through?
Well, I mean, no one likes uncertainty, but for the markets that we don't have access to and there's no dialogue, it is with great certainty that we're not going to be getting any of our products into those countries. So sometimes, I mean, our NPP association exists to develop trade and export pork products out of this country. And we've done a good job, 25% to 30%. So the fact is that we've been blocked out of so many countries. Even India is another huge example of an opportunity. I know that people don't think of them as an opportunity for pork, but there's a lot of Christians in India. And other minorities that eat pork, and as many people that are there, they are important too. But sometimes you really have to shake the tree to get the fruit to fall out. And I think that if you talk to the cattlemen, I think they feel the same way. They can't ship their beef to Australia, and the Australians are able to send their and lamb and all that into our country, same way with New Zealand. So I think sometimes you have to shake things up. But hopefully, based on what I heard in D.C., the directive was to shake it up and get these deals done so that we can get back with normalization with the partners that we do have good trade agreements with, and maybe open the doors to these others.
Those are good remarks. Marlo, I want to come back to you before I jump back to Zeb regarding prices. You mentioned that you're a millennial farmer. I mean, you're fourth generation. We were just talking about this off air. I'm certain many of the people that you interact with are in that same demographic down in Eastern North Carolina. What would you say the consensus is amongst this newer generation around the process that we're going through? Certainly for your generation, this is something that, even for my generation, we haven't seen this in 105 years. So
Yeah,
what's the reaction from young farmers?
it's definitely new, and that's why I really wanted, honestly, Dad to be on the call with me, because I feel like he's way more got a lot more experience talking about these subjects than I do. And I think that our main, from a row cropping perspective, I raise hogs, and I actually just built a poultry farm, a turkey farm this past year. But I think our biggest worry is input costs. I mean, I think input cost is probably the biggest thing on millennials' mind, especially from a row crops perspective. And, and our natural resources, how much it costs for gas and stuff like that. That would be probably our biggest concern is how to reduce our input costs. And a lot of that is affected by these, trade wars. That trickles down to the farmer, and I feel like it. Like I said in the beginning, the farmer has always been the one that kind of got the short end of the stick for a long, long time. And I feel like agriculture is really, especially with the food movement, a lot of people are starting to care a lot more where their food comes from. And it's hard as a millennial farmer to try to, I guess, educate folks about what goes into all that, producing your food and where it comes from. And it's not Charlotte's Web out here, and we're a real business, working every single day. Me and you've had the conversation of like, I don't look like a farmer. Everybody thinks this old McDonald had a farm and his coveralls with his pitchfork. So I think, it gets back to, what can we do as a business to stay profitable? And I think people miss a key point, sustainability. There's an economic footprint to sustainability. Me and you've had that conversation as well. So, we need to tap into being able to use what our country has to kind of reduce those costs. And it kind of goes back to what Dad say about having to rely so much on China. I mean, they've really kind of got us in a bind here. And open the opportunities for other free trade, countries and other places that we can have a relationship with where we can have better trade agreements. Canada, Mexico, Japan, all these countries that Dad's talking about that are open to better deals for us.
I see you rocking your NC pork shirt today, and big shout out to the North Carolina Pork Council. We love what they do here in the state. But I yes, the first time, just for my audience, the first time I met Marlo, she told me she was a hog farmer, and I said I don't quite see it. But agriculture here in North Carolina is such a huge industry. And I think the contributions that you're making, Marlo, along with all the millennial farmers that are coming into the industry, is so critical. And so we appreciate that. Zeb, Marlo just talked a little bit about having to pivot and making sure she maintains profitability. I know that's something that is constantly on your mind. I think about us folks in the food and beverage industry. We went through and survived COVID, and here just a short few years later, we seem to have another crisis on our hands. Zeb, when you think about profitability for your distillery, are you thinking about raising prices? Are you thinking about passing on some of these additional costs to your consumers?
I try to not do that as long as possible. We're going to sit back for the next year or two and kind of keep our prices where they are. Even if our glass goes up a dollar a bottle, I think long term it'll be more important to try to sustain. But if cost of goods keep going up, and I'm sure this year our corn's going to go up because it's costing more to do business. Fuel's up, So, at some point it does have to be passed on to consumer, but we're gonna hold steady over this next 365 days.
Are you thinking about it? Zeb, I tell the story oftentimes. You're gonna chuckle on this, but during COVID, for my audience that may be unaware, during COVID, when I had Zesto, we wasn't selling a lot of burgers and French fries because no one was coming in the store, but we were selling plastic jugs to Zeb, because Zeb needed all these plastic jugs to make hand sanitizer. And I love telling that story because it was like two small businesses doing, just literally pivoting and figuring out how to navigate through a tough time and supporting one another. And I think I still have some photos of you coming over and picking up cases and cases of plastic jugs. Are you thinking about any creative ways to pivot during this, or do you just feel like you're going to sit and hold still for now?
Well, fortunately, over the past few years, we've been very aggressive legislatively here in the state. Many of our laws here that regard alcohol are still dated back to prohibition or even before. And many of our legislators have no clue that a lot of these laws even exist on the books. So, fortunately, over the last few years, we've made some law changes that allow us to sell cocktails at the distillery, allows us to be open and sell bottles on Sunday, which is a major day for tourism across our state. It's also given us the ability to have a mixed beverage catering permit. So we as distillers can go in and cater spirits at weddings and other social events. So with that being said, we're going to shift around. We're going to take advantage of these law changes, get out and beat the streets and ride through it. It's just like any other storm, it'll pass.
I love it. That's the resilience of our small business community, not just here in North Carolina, but in every great state across America. For my audience, if you have not been to Old Nick Williams, if you live here in Winston-Salem, it's only 15 minutes out to Louisville. It's worth the trip. You're supporting a small business. Zeb and his family have been in that same area, in that same location, their entire lives. He and I go all the way back to West Forsyth High School. And I encourage my audience to take a trip out there, go take a tour, do a sampling. Typically, they have live music, food trucks, all types of things. So that's a shameless plug for Old Nick Williams here from my audience today. You know, Bob, I think I'm going to try to wrap my conversation up with you. You had some really good insight. I want to go back to something you said about the national pork producers that you work with. And the farmers that you work with all over the country. Many people, and I'll be honest with you, Bob, I'm one of many people that has really accused this administration of not knowing what the hell it's doing right now, and just all the uncertainty that it has created in our markets and the economy as it relates to this sort of unexpected trade war. But you are someone that's on the inside. You're being invited to meetings and spaces and places that I'm not actually sitting in. So I'm curious, was the farming community, were you all consulted and brought in b before these tariffs got announced? Were you part of the thinking process on this?
No, I mean, the NPPC actually has a lot is a lobbying group, and we've been lobbying for farm-friendly laws, lobbying for trade, for our whole existence since it was established. So we have a very big presence in Washington, D.C., and we're called in for like the Farm Bill. A lot of things that affect farmers. And this invite from the discussed trade was part of that relationship that we have in D.C. to not only to try to educate the Trump administration, but also our congressmen and senators.
With that said, I mean, what would you say, Bob, that you when I look at our policymakers in Washington, I'm often curious if they really truly understand what it means to run a family-owned business. Your family has been doing this for four or five generations. Is there anything that you wish policymakers better understood about the complexities of running a family-owned business?
Well, farmers, everything runs on energy. Everything moves up and down the road. Fertilizer is tied to energy. So, good energy policy is very important to us. Diesel tractors don't run good off batteries. So, we like good energy policy. And, a lot of the things that we source from China. We feel that that's not good for national security. We get our vitamins now from China. We didn't do that in the past. We get a lot of our medications from China, and really, We need to bring those critical needs back to this country because, I mean, it's a, not only is it a risk, but with the vitamin situation, we've actually seen where we brought in diseases to this country from pathogens that were outside of the country in China. So we're very vigilant. We try to communicate. And this is all part of the process. And it one thing's for sure with farming changes, the weather changes, and the political landscape is always changing.
I think those are wise words, Bob. This is my last question for you before I let you get back to the farm. With everything happening at a macro and national level, even at a global level, is there anything that you wish that North Carolina leadership and in the General Assembly was doing right now to help you all navigate some of this global pressure?
I think Zeb said it really, really good. I mean, they're looking at our state laws. They're making North Carolina a really good place to raise a family, have a farm, and they're using a lot of just good legislation to keep us going. And we all want to do things the right way, the best way, and you know the best practices, but they got to be reasonable. I think North Carolina's done a good job with trying to thread the needle and provide opportunity and keep farms sustainable and protect the environment.
Bob, thank you for that. I tell you, I feel a little bit better knowing that you are in the middle of the fight, having conversations with the right people so that we can navigate through this. I appreciate not only your service to North Carolina in terms of our agricultural industry, but I also appreciate your service in Washington and the work that you're doing to try to make sure the right people, our leaders, are rightly informed about what's going on. Marlo, thank you so much for bringing your dad along. He is now on the list of regular contributors.
He does a much better job than I ever was going to give to this topic. So that's why I told you, I was like, let me bring my dad in.
I've enjoyed him already. We will definitely have him back on. He and I will do a one-on-one conversation. I can imagine this issue is going to continue to be around. Yes. Most of this year, and certainly can use his expert insight as we try to analyze and break down what's going on and also try to help my audience understand what's happening, because people are really deeply concerned about what they're saying. I think people see the market and what's happening with the market, and we're fearful that that's going to spread into the economy. Zeb, as always, man, you're a longtime friend, always welcome here on the show. Thank you for everything you're doing for our community and the region as well. You want to say a couple last words or?
Hey man, I appreciate you, listening to me ramble and having me on today.
No, man, always. And I'll go ahead and put a bug out there for my audience. On May 29th, we will have an Eat, Drink, Triad showcase event at Old Nick Williams, out there on the Williams Farm. And I hope my audience will make a point to join us. Thank you all for locking in with me today. This has been a great conversation. Make sure you stay tuned to WTOB, because that's where you can lock in every Sunday morning. But if you happen to miss me there, hopefully you're subscribed to the podcast. You can download that on Spotify, Pandora, Apple, wherever you get your favorite podcasts, you can lock in there. As always, until next time, y'all stay locked in.
The executive producer of the Locked In podcast is Algernon Cash for WGC. The associate producer is Tim Beeman for Such and Such Media. This podcast is copyrighted and cannot be reproduced without express written consent of WGC.